He ran for Senate, then he ran for president. Neither worked out as he expected. Now Beto O'Rourke has a new plan. What that might mean for Texas, today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Beto bets on flipping the Texas House. Also, a federal plan to open up Texas forests to fracking. From Wall Street to Y'all Street, why a city in Texas is being talked about as a potential new capital for high finance. And you may have seen him on the posters at Subway sandwich shops. Who is Pitmaster Ramon, and is he for real? Those stories and a whole lot more on the national news show of You Know Where. The Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019. I'm David Brown. I bet you're wondering, whatever happened to Beto O'Rourke? Funny enough, it's a question not too many Texans have been asking, but it's one worth asking, especially as we read in several newspapers across the Lone Star State today that Democrat Beto O'Rourke, the former congressman from El Paso and former Democratic candidate for U.S. president, is now turning his attention to something much closer to home, specifically flipping the Texas House for the Democrats. Joining us now to talk about this is Sean Theriault. He is a professor at the University of Texas in Austin's Department of Government. He focuses on American political institutions. Professor Theriault, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
I'm happy to be on the show today.
So let's get at what is behind Beto O'Rourke's efforts when it comes to these Texas House seats. I think a lot of people figured that he would have his sights perhaps set on the U.S. Senate, if you know what I mean.
Right. So that Senate race has lots of candidates already in it, and he's sworn that race off too many times, I think, to make a credible push at this point to jump in that race.
But now he's looking at the Texas House. What does he think he can do, and why does he think he can do it?
So don't forget that he's sitting on a huge email list of people that gave tiny contributions multiple times over the course of his Senate run. Of course, he wasn't as good at utilizing that same email list for his presidential run, but he still, it's an enormous resource. And what he's looking at is all of these House districts. There's almost 20 of them where the Republican candidate won by less than 10 points. And in fact, he says that he had more votes than Ted Cruz in about half of them. So he thinks that he still has a role to play in helping the Democratic Party out. Maybe, you know, there's enough races that he could potentially flip. And it's a way of keeping his name in the news, I suspect.
Well, for those tuning into Texas politics rather late or perhaps newcomers to the state, just to be clear, we're talking about a shift in control of the Texas House of Representatives from Republican to Democrat, which I think not that long ago would have sounded like a rather Man of La Manchian endeavor indeed. Is it possible? How close would he be to actually making a difference?
Yeah, so what we have is we have two different trends that are occurring at the same time. One is that he ran an incredible race against Ted Cruz in 2018, and he got far closer than anyone thought he could. And more than that, he got the Democratic base really excited. In a way that Wendy Davis or some of the other candidates who had run statewide before never really kind of galvanized the base to get them as excited as Beto was able to do in the 2018 race. And then the second big trend that you have is the Trump presidency. He's refiguring what it means to be a Democrat and what it means to be a Republican. And we're seeing that play out, especially in some of these suburbs and our bigger cities in Texas, which is making the electorate a little bit more uncertain as to how they're going to cast their ballots come the 2020 races.
Are there enough seats, though, really in play already that could flip and turn it to the Democrats?
It's going to be tough, but as you noted just a minute or so ago, it's far closer than anyone thought they would be 5 years ago even. And so it's certainly worth the time and investment and energy the Democrats are pouring in to make this happen. Because we all know if they don't put the time and energy and money into these races, there's no chance that they could ever become a majority. And so maybe they only pick up two or three seats, but then we have 2022 and 2024. And perhaps, you know, in the not too distant future, Texas is once again a competitive state.
So what O'Rourke is trying to convince his donor base to do more specifically, he wants them to send money to an organization called Flip the Texas House. And they have targeted 17 House districts in which Republican candidates won by fewer than 10 percentage points last year. All this according to the Houston Chronicle. More than half of these are districts in which O'Rourke won the majority of votes when he ran for the U.S. Senate. So I understand what you were saying a little bit earlier there, Professor, about how he's said no to a U.S. Senate contest so many times it would be somewhat embarrassing for him to change his mind at this point. And yet, there are a lot of Texas Democrats who are still hoping he will do just that. Other than the obvious, perhaps embarrassment, maybe in flipping his opinion, what would be the downside in him trying to take on Cornyn?
Yeah, the downside is that at this point he's a one-time loser, maybe a one-and-a-half-time loser if you count the presidential race. And so if he adds this to the losing column, right, then I think that his future is pretty damaged in Texas going forward. He's a young guy, so he wants to maintain his relevance in the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. He's going to help out some of these state House races. And, you know, maybe there's a future for him. I mean, certainly he was able to galvanize that base. But let's not forget that his presidential run was a little bit more to the left than his Senate run. And so I think that the prospects for him against Cornyn is not Ted Cruz. And so I think that it's a far riskier race. And I think being a 2.5, 3-time loser would definitely be damaging for him.
Sean Theriault is a professor at University of Texas at Austin's Department of Government, where he focuses on American political institutions. Professor, great to talk with you again. Thanks so much for spending a couple of minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
It's my pleasure, David.
Ever had that feeling of deja vu? I had something of that feeling when I saw a headline at the Houston Chronicle today. Trump administration plans to open national forests in Texas to more oil and gas drilling. Joining us now is the author of that piece, Sergio Chapa. Sergio, good to have you back on The Standard. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Dave. Glad to be back.
The reason I said deja vu is because I can remember way back in the day, maybe back in the early 2000s, there being a hearty debate about the opening up of federal lands for oil and gas drilling. This at a time when Dick Cheney was the vice president and a former executive at Halliburton. What exactly is going on now, and why the push to open up national forests in Texas to more oil and gas drilling?
Well, this is part of a greater overall theme from the Trump administration of opening federal lands to more oil and gas drilling. So this comes as no surprise that they would also want to do that in Texas, where more than 90% of the land is private. But the few federal lands that are eligible for drilling, they're opening them up to this activity.
Where is this land that they're talking about?
Well, so there are 4 national forests in East Texas and 2 national grasslands in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We've got the Angelina National Forest, Davy Crockett National Forest, Sabine National Forest, and the Sam Houston National Forest just north of Houston.
Is there any real oil to be had in these areas or no?
Right. Well, yeah, actually, this is mostly a natural gas play. Both areas do have some oil. But the main target here appears to be natural gas.
So to get at this natural gas, I presume you have to use the latest extraction technologies, which means what? Fracking.
Yeah, exactly. So under the current proposal from the U.S. Forest Service, there are about 1,000 proposed horizontal wells and 500, you know, more traditional vertical wells proposed. That's about 1,500 new wells.
Wow.
Split between these forests and the grasslands.
Let me ask you something, because I recall that back during the last great push by the Bush administration, during that era to open up federal lands, there weren't a lot of takers. And now you take a look at what the economics are right now, and you're burning off natural gas out in the Permian Basin. Do you think anybody's really going to take the federal government up on opening up these lands to drilling, when especially given there seems to be so much production happening already out west?
Right. That's a really good, that's the really good question here. If they, even if they do open this up, will the market take it? I'll tell you what I do know. I do know that the Haynesville Shale of East Texas is the fourth most active shale play in the United States. It's natural gas, but it's also crisscrossed with pipelines that have already been built. And these pipelines feed even bigger pipelines that take natural gas all along the Gulf Coast from Mexico to Boston.
Yeah, I get it. So it's going to be more attractive because you got the infrastructure already in place. What about environmentalists and the pushback, which I'm imagining will be inevitable here if it hasn't already started?
Right. No, yeah. So we've already got a group opposing this proposal, and it's one of them is the Sierra Club, of course, here in Houston, and then the other one is the Center for Biological Diversity. Both have been vocal opponents, and both have been organizing their members and the public in filing comments opposing this proposal. Meanwhile, the oil and gas industry say this is it's safe and it's regulated, and there are already wells and pipelines in these forests.
Just a proposal, we should note, one that could have major implications for a good part of Texas. Sergio Chapa continues to cover this developing story for the Houston Chronicle. Sergio, thanks so much for your time.
All right, thank you.
Let's check in with our social media editor and find out what's the talk of Texas on this Tuesday. Hello there, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Well, we're hearing from folks about the topic just at hand, how the Trump administration plans to open nearly 2 million acres of Texas grasslands and national forests to oil and gas drilling. On our Facebook page, Brittany Lalu says, "Don't touch these lands." And Janice Hitchcock says, "Texans are getting tired of good old boys destroying our children's future just to line their own pockets." However, James Andrew Foster writes that those lands were open for oil and gas leasing just 3 years ago in many cases. These regulations were enacted by Obama as what he calls a spiteful political move, which were always destined for reversal. Also, James adds, if you're from Texas, you need to quit crying about this. It's beyond time that y'all get used to the fact that Texas is reliant on ONG, oil and gas production. Folks also talking about that story at the top of the show, Beto O'Rourke and his return to the world of Texas politics. I'll be back with those reactions and more later in the show.
All right, Texas, what you thinking? Yeah. We'd love to hear from you, because we won't know what's on your mind unless we do. So tweet us, won't you? Look for Texas Standard on your favorite social media platform. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back in 35.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Depression, anxiety, other mood disorders, are they caused by outside factors or something else? Something in the genes, perhaps. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie tells us a Texas researcher has come to some new conclusions that may help doctors be able to predict who's at risk and perhaps offer a path toward prevention.
Dr. Charles Nemiroff chairs the Department of Psychiatry at UT Austin, and he says all people are born with a genetic blueprint that includes gene variants that put them at risk for certain health problems, if the environment is right. For example, if someone has a gene variant that puts them at risk for cancer, they may remain cancer-free unless or until they're exposed to something in the environment that activates that risk, like cigarette smoke. Nemiroff says toxic stress and maltreatment during childhood can also influence what your genes do.
And it turns out that there are certain gene variants that interact with childhood maltreatment to regulate your relative vulnerability for depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other disorders.
So what if a person has gene variants that predispose them to developing a mood disorder, but they never experienced child maltreatment?
In our studies, there was no effect of having the vulnerability gene if you were never exposed to childhood maltreatment. But if you were, there it is.
Nemiroff says all of a person's gene variants add up to what he calls a polygenic risk score, which someday your doctor may be able to calculate for you.
We will in the future be able to look at individuals and say, your polygenic risk factor score suggests that you're vulnerable to bipolar disorder or depression or diabetes or asthma.
Armed with that knowledge, a patient or their parents could avoid things that might trigger their vulnerabilities. But for now, Nemiroff suggests organizations like the National Institutes of Health focus on preventing child abuse.
You know, we put appropriately tons of money into AIDS research, and look what happened. We developed treatments, we reduced all the misery that resulted in. Why can't we do that with child abuse?
Nemiroff says genes don't have to be destiny, and child abuse is 100% preventable. Reporting for the Texas Standard, I'm Bonnie Petrie.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you've got it tuned to the Texas Standard. Charles Schwab merging with TD Ameritrade, a big deal in the financial world. It's also going to have a big impact on North Texas. That's because the combined company's headquarters is moving from San Francisco to Westlake, up there in the DFW Metroplex, bringing with it some high-paying jobs. But perhaps the biggest takeaway from this big deal is that it's hardly an exception. Thousands of companies have been leaving California over the last decade or so, and many are finding a home in the Lone Star State. Dallas Morning News business reporter Dom DeFurio has been exploring this. Dom, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's talk about the bigger trends in just a moment, but I want to focus in on what Charles Schwab is doing here. They made that mega purchase of TD Ameritrade. They also purchased USAA's investment division, USAA, of course, based in San Antonio. They appear to see a financial services industry that's leaner, meaner, and a whole lot more competitive. And I'm wondering how the Dallas-Fort Worth area fits into those plans.
Right. So Dallas-Fort Worth is kind of seeing the financial services industry, or at least some giants like Charles Schwab, kind of consolidate over the center of the country here. They're not the first company to sort of find interest in the Westlake, Southlake area of Dallas-Fort Worth, turning Westlake into this, you know, financial center of Texas. A while ago, one of our columnists, I believe, actually referred to it as Y'all Street, sort of a play on Wall Street.
But
just, you know, it's this trend that really can't be ignored. And with Schwab's latest announcement, it's sort of solidifying that out there. I mean, Westlake is it's a wealthy area. There's a lot of folks out there that would probably tell you it's going to be a comfortable transition for folks from Northern California. As you were saying earlier, this is likely not the last California company that we'll see pack up and move out here to the Lone Star State.
I love that that expression, Y'all Street. That's pretty cool. But at the same time, Y'all Street could have been in El Paso. It could have been in San Antonio, certainly. I guess what I'm wondering is, what is it about Westlake? What is it about the area around the Metroplex that makes it such a potential magnet, do you think?
Right. We hear this from companies time and time again, that Dallas-Fort Worth is uniquely positioned, not just in Texas, but in the United States as a sort of travel hub. So these companies are international companies. They have national business, and executives are flying all over the place. The fact that Westlake is about 20 minutes from a world-class airport that can get you to just about any point in the U.S. in a couple of hours, as opposed to maybe, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours going coast to coast, that tends to be a huge factor for them. And, you know, when you're looking at California housing prices, you know, companies are looking at this and saying, you know, my employees, you know, dollars are going to go a lot farther if we can kind of shift them out here to North Texas. And then companies have been much more willing recently to be mobile like that, to kind of up and move a lot of their workforce across the country. And that's been an interesting trend to watch as well.
But I'm curious, because every time we sort of talk about relocations from California, the business of the cost of living and the tax landscape always come up. I'm wondering if there's like not a kind of specific gravity that's sort of being reached there in DFW when it comes to the financial services industry, if there's something else that's actually happening there, not just transport or the tax landscape.
It also does have to do with the domestic immigration rate here for young professionals, millennials. The Dallas-Fort Worth metro area tends to top that list of city centers that that millennials and young professionals are moving towards. So that workforce that is kind of pooling around the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I think is really important to these companies, especially as this last year we've seen the labor markets tighten so much. This is something that everybody's been watching, economists have been watching. Unemployment sits at about 3% across the country. But here in Dallas, you do have folks continuously, not just trickling in, but sort of rushing into the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area. So, you know, in tough economic times, and as we see this economic uncertainty around trade, trade deals with, you know, European countries and with China, a lot of companies are starting to take notice. And some analysts have said, you know, if any state is going to be able to weather uncertain economic conditions, it's going to be states like Texas and states like Florida, who have a proven track record of being very flexible in these time periods. For example, you know, look back to the 08-09 crash, a recession, if you will, and Texas came out of that, you know, relatively quickly compared to the rest of the states.
I guess it can't hurt any that the University of North Texas in Denton has emerged as a leader in data security, which is something that you point out in your piece. There's a whole lot more here, and we're going to link to it at texasstandard.org. Dom DeFurio is staff writer for the Dallas Morning News. Dom, thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, that last bit about the Denton factor, the UNT factor, how educational institutions play such a big role in attracting businesses. Definitely worth exploring a little bit more in depth, and I'm sure we will right here on The Standard. We've got the Texas Roundup just around the corner. You want to stick around for that.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, presenting Downtown Lasers and Lights, featuring synchronized laser shows and displays, lighting up Galveston's historic downtown with shopping, family-friendly attractions, and more. Galveston.com/holidaymagic. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. University of Texas researchers say the state's standardized tests are not asking too much from elementary and middle school students. The study, ordered by state lawmakers, finds the readability of STAR exams last spring was, by and large, appropriate for each grade level. The findings contradict research suggesting the tests did not accurately measure academic readiness. Central Texas Congressman Chip Roy is expecting a tough race for re-election in 2020. Texas Public Radio's Joey Palacios reports on the first-term Republicans' campaign launch last night.
Texas's 21st congressional district covers parts of San Antonio, the Hill Country, and Austin. The district has been a Republican stronghold for 40 years. Its incumbent, Chip Roy, told a crowd of about 200 people in San Antonio Democrats would try to influence the race with high amounts of money.
This is our Alamo. This is our moment for conservatism to shine and reign supreme. I do not buy this idea that Texas is flipping blue, and neither should you.
Filing for the seat closes Monday, December 9th. I'm Joey Palacios in San Antonio.
And at least two Democrats and an independent are running against Congressman Roy, including former State Senator Wendy Davis. Texans recovering from Tropical Storm Imelda have a day left to apply for disaster assistance through the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Spokesman Alberto Pilot says the aid is available to residents in seven southeast counties for immediate housing needs and other necessities.
It's called rental assistance, home repairs, or temporary housing. The second part was called other needs assistance, which includes personal property, which includes appliances, furniture, bedrooms, medical, it could be funeral, it could be storage.
Pilot says FEMA has so far approved more than $63 million in assistance for roughly 25,000 Texans affected by the storm last September. More information on how to apply is at disasterassistance.gov. And the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department is reminding hunters that new mule deer restrictions still apply for six counties in the Panhandle through the end of the season Sunday. The experimental rule bans harvesting the large-eared animals with main beam antlers less than 20 inches long. The department's Sean Gray explains it's intended to balance the overall population.
Our data shows that we're having a more skewed sex ratio, so that means more does to a buck and a younger age structure in the bucks. Primarily that's from over-harvest of the buck segment.
The antler regulations still apply in Briscoe, Childress, Cottle, Floyd, Hall, and Motley counties. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Visit Fredericksburg for biking, hiking, and birding, as well as arts and cultural events, and more than 150 shops in the National Historic District. More at visitfredericksburgtx.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Ever since President Trump began pulling the threads on the old world order, the international post-war consensus on security through multilateral agreements and mutual trade benefits, everyone wins, right? Scholars and lay folks alike have struggled to understand whether there's some unified principle behind Mr. Trump's trade wars and punitive sanctions like those he recently imposed on Brazil and Argentina, or if these are simply used by the Trump administration to throw America's weight around without rhyme or reason. A professor at Texas State University studying these patterns says we need to take this seriously. He's identified something that might well be described as a cohesive doctrine, the doctrine of offensive realism. Dr. Ionut Popescu is with Texas State University, and he's been writing about this for Political Science Quarterly. Dr. Popescu, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hello, David. Great to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about what this concept is of offensive realism. What does that mean? It sounds almost militaristic.
What it means is that the pattern of great power politics and great power competition is one that is bound to end in conflict. So what we're seeing now with the United States and China and Russia is not that unusual. In fact, historically, it's how the great powers always acted towards each other.
Now, is this something that the United States is instigating, or is this a reaction to something that authoritarian systems in China and Russia have actually instigated, and we're now kind of recognizing it as a result of this new administration's policy?
It is much more of the latter than the former. Basically, the United States, given our idealistic and liberal view of the world, for decades now believed that we could integrate Russia and China into a friendly international order. But clearly, as China and Russia developed more economic power, they increased their military power and they increased their aggressive nature. So now we're finally coming to realize that the pattern of great power competition has reemerged.
This is an entirely new concept, as I understand it. People have been talking about offensive realism for decades. It's just that it wasn't taken seriously in Washington for some time, right?
Yes, David, that's exactly right. There were scholars who were skeptical of the efforts to integrate China into the global economy in the hope of making them a peaceful democratic state. As early as 1990s, John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago had this prediction. But in Washington policy circles, the liberal view that we're moving towards a more peaceful, prosperous, open world prevailed. But of course, what happened was that rather than becoming more politically open and more willing to follow the international order that we were proposing, the Chinese government by and large took advantage of that, and now they are developing their own far less liberal order in Asia. And right now we're just facing the consequences of that shift on their part.
Help us understand something. Recently, in fact, in the past couple of days, there's been a lot of news about the United States imposing 100% sanctions on a lot of French goods. We have the tariffs that have been imposed on goods from Brazil and Argentina. How does that factor in to what you're describing as a kind of new look at China and Russia?
Well, there are two things here. First, in a realist competition, you are in fact more concerned with the current account deficit and with the relative gains from trade as opposed to the mutual benefits. That's consistent with the theory. Now, why is it that we're focusing on France and Brazil and Argentina, which are more or less on our side? That is less consistent with what offensive realists would like to do. So I would say that even in a great power competition, in a realist world, the importance of allies and alliances is still key, particularly as they can help us form these balancing coalitions against China and Russia and focus less on the immediate result of trade.
Professor, is this unique to Donald Trump?
No, David, absolutely not. And if we are going to have a new president next year or 5 years from now, this challenge of the rise of China and Russia and the competition between great powers will still be there. And I would bet that you will see far more continuity than change because the Trump administration is merely reacting and adapting correctly, in my view, to this pattern.
A new clash of the great powers, or at least a new view of it. Professor, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, David, and thanks to your listener. It was great talking to you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology. With more than 210 cancer centers across the state, patients can access technology, research, and treatment options in their local communities. More at texasoncology.com.
Hey everyone, this is Steffi Slays, and I am one of the WOW superheroes on WOW Women of Wrestling on Access TV. I am originally from Dallas, Texas. Alongside, I am working multiple jobs and going to school full-time in the medical field. So it's a lot of work, a lot of pressure that's put on me. But at the same time, I'm super happy and enjoying every moment of it. I was 17 when I first started, and I always tell people my body was like a noodle. Like, it's very noodly-like, flimsy, I'm clumsy. So to start off as somebody who can't even stand straight without falling to now being a strong female wrestler, I am still surprised. And it took a lot of training, and I pretty much eat just fish. Tuna, to be specific, which is not the greatest all the time. But it's hard because, you know, you're from Texas and all I want to do is just eat ribs and I can't do that anymore. So when I first started, I was in a really bad place. I've been bullied throughout middle school and high school. I came to a place where I no longer wanted to exist, and I no longer had confidence in myself, and I just felt empty. Wrestling gave me life again, and it gave me a reason. And because of wrestling, I was able to gain confidence and find who I really was, and that is somebody who is a survivor. This is what wrestling does for me. It's more of a self-healing process rather than wanting to go for the championship belt or wanting to be on television and be famous. Hey you guys, it's Steffi Slays and I'm a WOW superhero from WOW Women of Wrestling on Access TV, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
If you live in Texas and you've been around a subway any time the past few months, you may have noticed a poster featuring a man they call Pitmaster Ramon. The poster reads, "For our new pit-smoked brisket, every whole cut of meat is naturally slow-smoked for at least 13 hours by Pitmaster Ramon and his crew, because nothing compares to the authentic smoky flavor you get from the pit," so says the Subway Sandwiches poster. Well, Daniel Vaughn is the barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. He saw this poster, too, and began to wonder if Pitmaster Ramon himself is really cooking up this meat, as the poster suggests, or if he's a stock stand-in for a good story. So, Daniel, is Ramon a real pitmaster?
Pitmaster Ramon does exist. He is a real person. I knew that one of their suppliers was Sadler's Smokehouse. They are in Henderson, Texas. It's a huge facility. They put out, you know, just hundreds and thousands of pounds of brisket. And I asked Sadler's and Subway about this, and they wouldn't confirm or deny it. But, you know, where they're quiet, Reddit is not. And there is a specific channel for Subway on Reddit.
And that's where you found a few clues about
Yeah,
that?
I found somebody had posted an image of one of the boxes that the brisket had come in, and it did come from Sadler's.
So so who is Ramon? Do you know what his last name is? It's not on the poster, I don't think.
It's not on the poster, and neither Sadler's nor Subway would tell me, but I did find an article in the National Provisioner from 2005 that talked about a Ramon Gonzalez at Sadler's Smokehouse, and at the time, he had been at Sadler's for 25 years. So on the poster here, it says he's worked there for 38 years. So after I saw that that article mentioned Ramon Gonzalez at Sadler's, I went out to Henderson and, you know, I asked around. I went to two different Subway locations there. His poster is prominently displayed inside. I asked the folks inside if they knew Ramon. They did not. They actually kind of laughed. They did confirm, however, that the brisket does come from Sadler's. So at least if you're in Henderson, you're going to get local brisket on your Subway brisket sandwich. And then I went to Sadler's, and they have a street that separates their employee parking lot and the facility where they smoke all those meats. And so I stopped there at the crosswalk right after the lunch hour to let some folks pass in front of me. I did not see Pitmaster Ramon. I was hoping to, and maybe get a selfie or something. But I did talk to a guy who worked in there. He had coveralls on. And I asked him if the famous Pitmaster Ramon, the guy from Subway, worked there. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me kind of funny. And then I said, you know, Subway. And he's like, oh, Ramon. Yeah, yeah, Ramon works in here. So that was sort of my confirmation there.
But why would Subway and others not want you to meet this storied pitmaster?
Well, that's the question I've been asking both of them. You know, I got stonewalled from both when trying to get any information on Ramon. I also got stonewalled when I sought an interview with him, even to get confirmation that he worked for Sadler's. There was just sort of a no comment from Sadler's, and then there was sort of this boilerplate response from Subway. And, you know, it kind of bugged me because, well, first of all, I'm a journalist and I want to talk to these people, but I'm truly interested in his story. Like when I put out this poster on Twitter first, you get this sort of reaction of, oh, he's fake and, you know, Ramon's made up or yeah. Like you mentioned before, it's a stock image or, but he's a real person. He's worked at Sadler's for 38 years. And, you know, most of the pitmasters that I talk to, they're small batch pitmasters. I mean, even the biggest restaurants out there aren't cooking anything like what Sadler's puts out. So I was really interested in his perspective on, you know, what it's like to work for a company that's putting out this much. How do you actually watch a pit that is putting out this many briskets? And, you know, basically, what's it like to be the guy who's in like 24,000 locations of Subway across the country?
He's the face, in a way, he's the face of authentic barbecue. Or at least that's the way that Subway is presenting him.
Yes, almost like a mascot. You know, I talked to a few folks about it, including Toni Tipton Martin. She is the James Beard Award-winning author of The Jemima Code. Mm-hmm. Her first outburst was, that sounds like a modern-day Aunt Jemima to me. In Aunt Jemima, Uncle Ben, these images that were placed on these you know, big commercial products to help sell them when, you know, the idea of who these people were didn't really matter. And basically, it was just these people using people of color for a mascot for their product. And, you know, I see this older Hispanic gentleman standing in front of this barbecue pit with the name Pitmaster Ramon, almost like he's a superhero, not like he's an actual person. And the fact that Subway nor Sadler's has any interest in letting Ramon tell his story, if he's interested, or them just wanting to, you know, crow about one of their employees, kind of was unsettling.
So you've written this story for Texas Monthly in which you're talking about the use of Pitmaster Ramon as a kind of a prop, like Aunt Jemima or Uncle Ben. Has there been much of a blowback from Subway or from Sadler's?
I mean, we gave them the opportunity to comment specifically on some of those questions that we raised in the story, and we didn't hear anything back.
I've been talking with Daniel Vaughn. He is the barbecue editor over at Texas Monthly. We're going to link to his latest over at texasstandard.org. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Howdy, it's the Texas Standard you're listening to. I'm David Brown. Five detention centers scattered throughout West Texas and New Mexico house thousands of people trying to enter the U.S., many seeking asylum here. Several of these centers are in remote desert towns, far from law offices, which may be a more significant factor than they or many others fully realize. KERA's Mallory Falk reports.
When Jesus Enrique Rodriguez Mendoza turned himself in to immigration officials, he figured he'd be detained, but assumed it would be for a short time. Instead, he spent nearly 2 years in an El Paso detention facility.
You feel like you're being punished, and it's a horrendous feeling.
Rodriguez says that's not what he expected after fleeing political persecution in Venezuela. The detention center, a sprawling facility near the airport, did have a law library. He spent a lot of time there to sharpen his legal knowledge and prepare for court. It also took his mind off his medical situation. Rodriguez is HIV positive and says it took months to receive the right medication. His health deteriorated.
I really thought that we'll die inside the detention. For me, dying was a possibility, and quite honestly, the decision is, should I die here in the U.S. or should I go and die in Venezuela on the hands of the regime?
His bookish habits caught the eyes of other detainees. Rodriguez says some approached him, asking for legal advice on their asylum cases. He realized for many, getting a lawyer was out of reach.
They would call to numbers, and there was lines and lines of people waiting for representation. So there is nowhere to turn. Regardless of how well qualified the asylum cases were, they were not able to get the right legal representation because the organizations there were completely overwhelmed.
Nonprofits like ours, we certainly do the best that we can, but the need is very great.
Linda Corchado is director of legal services at Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center in El Paso.
We don't have enough people on the ground hitting the streets and really helping as many people as they can.
This is a big issue. Beyond a few dedicated nonprofits like Corchado's, there aren't many free or low-cost legal services in the region. No huge law firms with pro bono programs. There's no law school in El Paso. The closest is hours away from the border in Albuquerque. Even for the lawyers who are on the ground, visiting detained clients can be hard. Allegra Love is an immigration attorney based in Santa Fe. To get to the nearest detention center,
I have to drive 2 hours. It's 150 miles to get out there. And so if I'm going to visit a client, we're talking about a 4-hour round trip to do any sort of detention visitation.
Many nonprofit attorneys can't justify the long trips. Private attorneys charge for travel time. It's not just the El Paso sector. A study from the University of Pennsylvania Law Review found detainees in urban areas were at least 4 times more likely to have lawyers than detainees in rural areas.
Even in places where there are legal service providers, you see people having no access to counsel because counsel is having difficulties getting into a detention center.
Estrella Cedillo is an immigration attorney in El Paso.
And then on top of that, you add the fact that sometimes people get transferred between detention centers and you don't know why or when or how they're getting transferred. And then that person has to start over again.
And all this makes a serious difference. Asylum seekers with lawyers are 5 times more likely to win their cases, according to the TRAC research project at Syracuse University. For Jesus Enrique Rodriguez Mendoza, the asylum seeker from Venezuela, spending time in a detention facility brought these disparities into sharp relief.
I feel lucky that I have that choice to contact private lawyers. But what about those that don't have the resources that I have? Would they be less qualified for asylum than me?
Lawyers here think that's a deep injustice, and one they're working to solve. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Tomorrow, KERA's Mallory Falk tells us about a new legal collaborative that's trying to offer representation to more asylum seekers in ICE detention.
Support for coverage of business on Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp insurer, providing information, resources, and support to help injured Texas workers get back on the job and back to their lives. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, look who's here. It's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hi there, David. Well, as we heard at the top of the show, Beto O'Rourke re-entering Texas politics, working towards turning the state house blue. We talked about that, lots of reactions about that. And another interesting aspect of this news, it comes as a new poll shows a glide path for O'Rourke to win the Democratic primary to take on John Cornyn. This poll released Monday by the Democratic Policy Institute found that O'Rourke would do better in a matchup against John Cornyn than the four other declared candidates.
Yeah, we were talking about that in our conversation. But I don't know if Beto's going to...
It seems like...
I don't think this makes a difference.
He has seemed to have indicated that that ship may have sailed, but there still is a week or so remaining to file for a run.
Right.
In our comments, we're seeing a lot of reactions lamenting that this basically wasn't O'Rourke's plan to begin with. Via Facebook, Matt Weiss calls O'Rourke's plan too little too late, and says he should have been out there running for Senate this whole time. Meanwhile, Robert Salazar says it's infuriating that O'Rourke wasted his popularity and abandoned Texas for the national spotlight. This is what many Texas Democrats were asking him to do from the beginning.
One of the things I think is kind of fascinating, you try to imagine, say, 5 years, 10 years from now, if someone's trying to write the story of Beto O'Rourke, how does that read? I mean, how's that going to read to people in the future that this guy who was a congressman from El Paso, you know, he comes out, you know, just taking on the world. He almost beats Ted Cruz. Doesn't happen. But then he runs for president. I mean, a lot of people thought.
And it's, you know, we've seen that at so many different levels, these sort of rising Democratic stars like Stacey Abrams. I'm thinking of some other candidates whose names escape me
Wendy
right now.
Davis was somebody.
Yeah, people that sort of reached for that brass ring and didn't quite get it, but Golden still became household names in the process. Well, speaking of politics, here's an odd one. Fort Bend County, one of the most diverse counties in Texas, if not the nation, very close to evenly split between Anglo, Hispanic, Asian, and African American residents. But so while some might see diversity there, Republican Representative Rick Miller of Sugarland apparently sees a plan to drive him out of office. Here's the story. In recent remarks that were just reported by the Houston Chronicle, Representative Miller said that he's drawn two of the challengers he's facing in the GOP primary simply because they are Asian. Odd remarks. He said, quote, he said this of one challenger, J.C. Jetton. The representative said, he has decided because he is an Asian that my district might need an Asian to win. And that's kind of racist in my mind, said their Republican Representative Rick Miller of Sugarland. He made similar remarks about another challenger he's facing, Leonard Chan. And he's drawn a lot of fire or ire for these remarks as well, I might say. I shared this stuff on Twitter and actually got a response from one of these candidates challenging him. Leonard Chan tweeted me that I do have some qualifications, and that's beyond being class president of my elementary school. So I would say stay tuned to this one. We probably haven't heard the last about this story emerging there.
Sparks flying already. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you will join us. Till then, I'm Dave Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.